Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. When a mob breached security at the U.S. Capitol building on January 6th, some of the most photographed members of the group were associated with extremist groups and the conspiracy theory QAnon. Today we learn more about QAnon, how members are spurred to violent action, and how to recognize some of the theories online and in your personal conversations. Joining us today, we have Jack Bradich. He's an associate professor of journalism and media studies at Rutgers School of Communication and Information. Jack, welcome to In the Moment. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me, Lori.
I want to start with a basic question. What exactly is QAnon for the uninitiated?
Right. So QAnon I consider to be a kind of militant spiritual movement that has coalesced around Donald Trump loyalism. And really, it was spurred on in the late 2017 by a figure who goes by Q, who claimed to be a military insider and began posting things to different platforms that got people excited about an upcoming coup that they imagined that was going to happen with President Trump. So it's mutated in different ways since then, but there's some core beliefs around the fact that they think that, you know, there's a deep state at work in the U.S. and around the world, and that deep state is in league with Satan and is involved in child trafficking and pedophilia and cannibalism, some very terrible things. So, but that's the kind of core belief system that that you can identify with QAnon. It has this both kind of secular military version and then this other kind of more transcendent spiritual dimension to it as well.
Tell us a little bit about how the conspiracy built or the movement built in the days ahead of the insurgency at the U.S. Capitol. Were QAnoners involved in that insurgency, and were there signs that it was building toward that kind of violent action?
Yes, for sure. There, I would say that since November 3rd, since the election, what I call the kind of QAnon world of influencer agitators have been very active in promoting the idea, first of all, that the election was stolen. And they kept sort of promoting that and getting their followers kind of worked up around that and told them to kind of keep the faith, keep the line going, hold the line. They give all these kind of phrases, military-like phrases, to kind of keep morale up around this. And even as each, you know, sort of obstacle or challenge came to the up to the plan, that is, court cases failed, evidence was never shown, they continued to push and focus then on January 6th as a major day in order to disrupt the certification procedure that was going on in Congress. So there was a buildup not just to a specific, you know, kind of stop the steal movement that was going to happen on January 6th, but this larger idea that that they needed to mobilize, sometimes with language involving civil war even. So yes, it was very agitational and very focused on January 6th around street actions and mobilizations.
You mentioned some of the military language and sort of that, you know, call to be part of something greater than yourself. And I would say as an American veteran, if I know anybody who has fallen into this conspiracy theory or who I'm concerned about, it's my friends who are veterans. And of course, we saw clearly not all friends who are veterans, but they come from the one or two people I know have come from the veteran community is what I mean to say. And certainly we saw veterans at the U.S. Capitol. And what gives, Jack? Why are U.S. military members who swore to defend the Constitution of the United States showing up at Black Lives Matter rallies saying that they're going to defend the Constitution by being between protesters and law enforcement, and then on this other side showing up at the U.S. Capitol in military gear that they have pilfered in some cases and using it to breach the U.S. Capitol building? Why?
Yeah. No, that's a great question. I mean, I think what's happened is that, you know, there's been a kind of fragmentation, perhaps, within the military itself around what it means to defend a constitution. Because for a lot of these folks that you hear talking about, they consider themselves strict constitutionalists, right? And they think they're protecting the Constitution from what they consider to be enemies, domestic and foreign. I mean, so for some, I think it's still in line with some version of what they think the kind of the honorable and just thing to do is. I think others have sort of, you know, taken some training and skills and moved it into, you know, other forms of, you know, certain kinds of war games or training. And, you know, it's not unusual to have seen that kind of overlap in the past with, you know, some even like white nationalist movements overlapping with ex-military. So, you know, I think the military isn't a single, you know, a single identity. And I think there's what we've been seeing is an increasing number, at least sort of like not just believing in this, but almost bringing their skills and coordination capacities to some of this. And I think at the root of it, too, because QAnon itself, you know, it sort of claims to be a military operation at times. They think Q is a military insider who has all this knowledge, and that the goal the final kind of battle will be a military coup. So they think that they're actually working within certain strains of the existing state forces and military forces. So it's a fascinating moment. I think your question raises about a different kind of, you know, interests and orientations even within what we think of as a single military.
And this idea of a chain of command in the military is just so critical, including the United States Commander in Chief. And I can imagine that the inconsistency with what the president was telling people, for some of those people, they saw it as a call from the Commander in Chief of the United States of America. And so that leads to my next question, which is, does this change when President Joe Biden is in office? And does it diffuse a little bit of that because we don't have Donald Trump in the White House, or does it make no difference whatsoever?
That's going to be a great question to see how that plays out, because I think for some, they will never accept, again, this is going to be a strange moment in the chain of command, you're right, that they have a single commander-in-chief, that even if Trump is in exile or an outside, that the loyalty they have, not just to him, but to their own idea of what, again, the Constitution is and who is corrupting it, we could see, you know, some strengthening of loyalties, I would say, even without the kind of institutional backing that we presume when we think of as a commander-in-chief. I mean, I think this is, again, where the transcendent component or the religious or spiritual dimension of this plays in, because the higher power becomes, you know, something beyond a kind of secular constitution and becomes something more divine, or a play of good and evil that they're also invested in as a narrative about how the world works.
So for the rest of us who are kind of, you know, on the outside of this, living our regular lives and then seeing friends and family online, you know, post things, there's certain phrases there. I mean, the notion of having words or even gestures or, you know, the letter Q on a sign or a T-shirt is a message to others. Tell us a little bit about how to recognize some of these, you know, signposts of QAnon.
Right. Well, so some of the more specific phrases would be around hashtags like dark to light, or where we go one, we go all, usually abbreviated, and it's just the first letters. You know, the trust the plan, you know, the great awakening. So some of these might not even seem so specific to be indicators, but they usually involve like people who want to kind of recruit and convert others. So things like the Great Awakening involves like people saying, well, you know, we're just raising people's awareness of this or that, or Save the Children even, which was the really interesting one, the hashtag, where it seems really, you know, both innocuous and important to save children, obviously. But at the same time, what happened was that was a way of recruiting people into something more core to the kind of, you know, fringe version of QAnon, which is we're saving the children from the Democratic Party, who, in their minds, right, are again are trafficking them. So sometimes it's hard to see what the cues are because they seem again kind of innocuous. But once people begin to almost talk about this moment in history as like the, you know, an apocalyptic one, or that they send you a few links, right, to some sites and say, like, start here, and there's a few videos that people often start with to sort of get recruited into. And so sometimes it's harder to get. I think the key is to, you know, ask people who you might think that are close to you that are going down into these vortexes and these rabbit holes to sort of say more, and to sort of, you can really kind of hear where they're coming from at some point in order to hopefully be able to give them some other way of seeing the world. And sometimes it's kind of hard to do, obviously, because people have gone down so far that they've sealed themselves off from anything except, you know, kind of converting others.
There is a sense that I have noticed of people, it's very important to them that you understand that, you know, the media isn't telling the true story, or nobody's talking about this, or I understand something that other people don't understand. Are you finding some kind of, you know, fulcrum point, a tipping point where there is a inspiration around the fact of being someone who sees something that nobody else is, you know, like the, you know, I think of the map on the wall with all the strings going back and forth, and like, when is that just good planning, and when do you fall into it and become tangled up to it? Because not everybody who is part of this movement started out, you know, with a mental illness or a violent tendency. I mean, these are regular people who somehow have been inspired to take extraordinary illegal and violent action that's very unexpected from their friends and family. Talk a little bit about being pulled into the vortex and some of the things that, you know, a cult or a conspiracy theory or a, you know, an extremist group does to sort of flip that switch for people.
No, that's really a question for our times, because I really like the image, you know, the kind of really classic image of the individual in a basement or in a room with all of the note cards and the strings and the different kind of connections that are made. And now what's happened is that wall that used to be your own kind of set of connections now is the internet, right? And so then what people kind of stumble upon as individual users is an already existing growing map that others are sort of feeding into. So it could appear as though you're discovering something. You're not creating these connections all the time. You're making some connections. Most of the time the connections are there, you're just kind of discovering it. And there's a powerful thought for people when they come to understand themselves as having been awoken from something, right? From being, having been asleep to being now awake and aware of things. And that can really drive people to do things that they wouldn't normally do, because they feel like they have access to a truth of the world, not just in the truth in the sense of evidence. In fact, sometimes not evidence, but it's a way of seeing truth with a capital T. And it has a kind of religious flavor to that. That is a kind of moment of the kind of awakening again, or revelation. And so I think what's happened is that people have also then found very quickly that their own awareness is meaningful, because other people are also going through it right now. So people who have been isolated, who have been lonely, and this is, I think, an important moment around the, you know, different kinds of quarantine and isolation that happened around coronavirus, is that people then sought forms of community and meaning out in the world. And here was QAnon as a community that was developing over, at that point, 2.5 years, that was sort of ready for people to come into it. So I think it's important to also recognize, you know, the year that we've had has pushed people, both because of precarious life circumstances, economic, psychological, and then also have sort of pushed them into finding grand meaning in things now.
All right. So what happens next. And my first question is, how seriously do law enforcement and political leaders and business leaders and whomever, how seriously do we need to take someone's sort of dabbling with QAnon and, you know, the movement in general and its potential for domestic terrorism, for violent action, you know, for some kind of extremist behavior? How serious is it?
Yeah. Well, I think a number of things. I think it's serious insofar as at the very core of it, the beginning of it, was this kind of fantasy of a military solution to political matters, right? That the idea was that there was going to be a coup. That was at the very beginning of Q in 2017. So I mean, it's embedded inside the overall belief system of what's going to happen in the future. So that's you know, essential to it. I think what's happening right now, since I would say, you know, October, November, this is where QAnon has mutated a bit. Whereas we see that many people on January 6th, who stormed the Capitol, were QAnon adherents, right? Two of the five people that are dead as a result, had, you know, posted QAnon content, and even the, Sicknick, the police officer, had followed, Q influencers on Parler, right? So it's pretty pervasive in a small group, but it's still pretty pervasive. So I think what's happened, though, in the last couple of months is that people don't even wear a Q anymore. QAnon has kind of disappeared into the crowd, rather than being the forefront of. What I mean by that, for instance, the Q figure has not posted since December 8th. That's a long time. So in the midst of all this, the key figure is no longer even posting. I think what's happening now is that the effects and the legacy of QAnon are outlasting even the name. So people don't even have to say it to kind of be fueled by the story and the kind of, again, transcendent experience that it has provided for people. So I think that's the most kind of interesting or worrisome component, is that it's actually not that identifiable, especially now that, you know, tech platforms are kind of, you know, banning outright QAnon influencers. So it's hard to figure out where and how it's moving.
Yeah. Well, that's where we stand today, and we'll keep following this story in the days ahead. Our guest has been Jack Bradich. He is an associate professor of journalism and media studies at Rutgers School of Communication and Information. You're welcome back anytime. Thanks for being here.
Thanks, Laurie. Thanks for having me.